Welcome to this week's episode of Real Estate Served on the Rocks. On this week's episode, the guys talk all about secondary properties. What does financing look like? Should you do short or long-term rentals? As well as some other things you should think about if you're considering buying a second property. All while sipping and reviewing a standard in the bourbon industry. Eagle Rare, aged 10 years, Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey. What is up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Real Estate Served on the Rocks, powered by Living in Colorado, The Mile High Perspective on YouTube, Fathom Realty, and Keller Williams Downtown. My name is Charlie Sardelli, and as always, I'm here with
Jameson Amaros,
Oscar Ibarra,
and we are at the Rouge Wine and Bourbon Bistro, as we are every week, our beautiful sponsor here down in Greenwood Village. So come check them out. They are doing an awesome, awesome tasting opportunity with Green Dot, Yellow Dot, or Green
Spot,
Green Spot, Yellow Spot, and Gold Spot. It's $58. You get a 2 ounce pour of each, so you get to taste some awesome Irish whiskey.
You do.
That is hard to find, especially that Gold Spot.
Triple pot distilled.
Yes.
No, what's going on?
So they're running.
I've been out of
out of the Rouge.
I had to work.
So they're running a special where you can get a flight basically of three of the Spot. Irish whiskeys, Green Spot, Yellow Spot, and Gold Spot.
Awesome.
Gold Spot is really hard to find. And for a 2 ounce pour of each, it's only $58, where normally you'd be looking at probably $75, $80 for all three of those for a 2 ounce pour. So it's a great deal. Great
deal. So $50 gets you all three of them?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yep. And on this podcast, guys, as you can tell, we talk about bourbon, talk about whiskey, but we also like to talk about real estate. And on today's episode, the topic that we're going to be going through is a little bit about investing in secondary properties. So what's the difference between short-term and long-term? What do you have to consider when thinking about investing in a secondary property? What does it go into as far as financing, down payments, all that kind of stuff? So stay tuned for that. But as always, before we get into the topic of real estate, we're drinking bourbon. And so this week, Chris isn't here, so we kind of got to pick the bottle that we were drinking today. And we went with Eagle Rare, Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey. And you've heard Jameson talk about it, Oscar talk about it. It's kind of a staple on that top shelf. And the reason that I wanted to go with this bourbon today is because we did have the Rouge Buffalo Trace. And like we said, Eagle Rare, Buffalo Trace, Pappy Van Winkle, Blanton's, they're all made by the same distillery.
Mm-hmm.
And Eagle Rare, one thing that it keeps to its name and one reason why people know it as a top shelf whiskey is because it's aged 10 years. And if you're on the video version, you can see how dark this bourbon is. I'm going to go ahead and pop the bottle and pour it out if you guys want to talk about it a little bit.
I mean, it's one of my staples at my house. I love Eagle Rare. I mean, basically the lineage for Buffalo Trace is that entire lineup. Buffalo Trace, Blanton's, E.H. Taylor, Eagle Rare, Pappy Van Winkle, and they're essentially just different Blends. Ages and barrels of each other that as you go farther and farther into that lineage, technically get better and better whiskey. But Eagle Rare, I don't know how to explain it other than it doesn't taste like a normal 10-year. And I actually, from a price standpoint, I like it better than Blanton's.
I agree. I think for a while there, well, all of bourbon went up, right?
Yes.
Weller's.
I didn't even mention, all the Weller line too.
Is I mean, it's kind of like it's a pedigree of good bourbon. You know, the Blanton's is a certain Rick House, and that's where they bottle in the story behind that. E.H. Taylor is my favorite out of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But Eagle Rare is very consistent, just all around good. I mean, I've never met anyone that had anything bad to say about Eagle Rare.
It tends to be overpriced.
Yes, and that's where I was going. Sorry, that my mind is everywhere right now. It a lot of liquor stores tend to overprice it. I found it for $40 at times.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck finding it for that cheap.
Yeah, if you're $40-$50, I think it's a good.
Yeah,
you pick it up no matter what.
And for a 10-year, that's great. But people try to sell it for like $100.
Well, and I think that's a good point that you both make is that Eagle Rare is, and that's what, again, why I wanted to go with this bottle is because it's a top shelf, very known, 10-year aged. And, I mean, this one is sitting at...
Barrel pick, this one?
No. This is a regular bottle.
Okay.
Yeah, so this one is sitting at 45%, so it's only 90 proof.
Yeah.
Right? And, I mean, the barrel pick of the Buffalo that we had was 112.
Correct.
So that,
no. No.
Wasn't it?
Buffalo was still 90.
Oh, no, that was last week. That was a three course.
Don't tell me what you had. Because every time I'm not here, these guys are like, oh, man, you missed out. We had this, like, specialty bottle. It was, like, $1,000, and it tasted like beautiful unicorn tears.
We're not saying nothing. But no,
how did he know about the unicorn tears last week?
I don't know. I don't know, dude.
That sucks.
He's got a mic somewhere in here. What the reason I'm excited for this too is
those
because
cameras aren't the Rouge's cameras.
Yeah.
Those are Big Brothers.
The reason I want to do this is because it is a staple, but I've never really like tasted Eagle Rare to taste it, to put it up against and review it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Also I haven't let one sit for the duration to see how that opens. But let's go ahead and I'm going to get my nose in it. See what we got going on here. Oscar, I'll pass you yours.
Sorry. Thank you.
Good? James. Cheers, just so we don't have to sit up again. I want to see. So this doesn't have like nose notes on it. So I'll be interested to see what you guys pull from it. It does have the tasting notes. So, I mean, right off the bat, the burn is there on the nose, but it's more of a flavor with the burn than it is like an ethanol burn.
You know, it's been, what, 2 weeks since I've been back. I missed 2 weeks. Haven't been drinking bourbon either. So, like, my nose is back. For a while there, I couldn't really smell a lot. And it's clean.
Honey.
If I could, like, the first, it's a very clean.
The honey on it.
Clean nose.
A little bit of toffee.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, toffee.
Like an orangey. Like
citrus. Definitely a citrus
like an
in
orange,
there.
An orange peel almost.
Mm-hmm. Vanilla blossoms.
Yep. The oak is coming through, but on like it's very, very low.
Mm-hmm.
It's subtle on the nose.
Yeah, that toffee with that citrus is a unique.
Interesting. Huh.
And the burn's not bad.
It's, you know, it's funny because I think the last time I had Eagle Rare was like before, like actually sat down and enjoyed it was before we started doing the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
because we haven't had it on the podcast.
No, and it's so crazy like just to see the evolution of it.
It is one of my favorite drinkers.
All right, well, I'm going to go ahead.
It's also very dangerous.
Kind of like a Milky Way nugget.
Almost.
That kind of candy. Caramel. What kind of candy is that?
No, it's like caramel.
I got like a toffee.
Nougat. What's a nougat? I mean,
I think nougat's just like coffee with like almonds.
Maybe it's
or
almonds.
Or not coffee, Jesus Christ. Chocolate with almonds.
There is a chocolate.
Because you know that, marshmallowy.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. God, I haven't had a fucking Milky Way in a long time.
Who eats those? I mean,
dude, I used to.
Who eats Mars bars?
I mean, I'm always. Hey, here, this is random side as we're talking about these tasting notes. What's your guys' go-to candy bar?
I don't.
I mean, mine's a Reese's.
I used
candy bar.
That's a candy bar.
That's not a candy bar.
It is a candy bar.
Reese's is a cup.
Okay. It is a cup. No, candy
what
bar.
Other, what
rectangle.
What other category?
Rectangle.
Am I going to put it in?
Like a long
it's own
like a
candy
long,
cup?
Yes.
Are there other candy cups?
No.
That's what I'm saying. So
I mean, Reese's kind of monopolized the cup.
They do.
There is no other.
Yeah,
so,
you can't.
So it's a candy bar.
No,
it's just
not.
In cups.
It's not a candy bar.
The packaging is a bar.
No, it's two circles.
No, I'm saying.
Is Kit Kat a bar?
Yes.
I can see that more as a bar.
Exactly.
But
a Reese's cup is different.
But I'm saying if you look at the packaging, if you don't open it up, you don't know it's two
what
cups,
if it's
it looks
a,
like
what
a
what if it's a Reese's mini? Is that also a candy bar? If they're this big?
The individual?
Yeah.
See?
Exactly.
Okay. All right, fine. No, you know what?
I think Reese's is more in the category of
Reese's,
like a Rolo.
Reese's does
it's kind
make
of like a truffle, right?
A bar.
Yes.
Reese's does make a bar that you can break off.
You're not allowed. Pick something else.
If I have to pick Snickers.
Okay. Oscar?
I mean, I used to be a big Baby Ruth fan.
Okay.
But I haven't seen a Baby Ruth.
That's because you play baseball. That's why.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe.
I'm a Twix man.
Really?
I love Twix, too.
Left
Twix
right.
Are good.
Oh,
Twix
left.
And Kit Kats.
Fuck right, Twix.
Oh, man. That's awesome.
I mean, did you ever eat the Zero Bars?
Uh-uh.
Yes.
Talk about a weird
that
candy bar.
Weird, yes.
It's like a white Snickers.
No, the weirdest candy bar was the, is it Paydays? That have nuts on the outside?
It's a nut
chocolate.
Roll.
Yeah. I don't like that. I don't like that at all.
And then there was one that has like, there was a payday-ish kind of,
I think
that,
it was payday,
that had
right?
a,
yeah.
It was like a big hunk.
Yeah.
Those?
Yeah, yeah.
But it was like a payday.
Yeah.
And it was called a nut roll or something.
I'll tell you
I
what
like,
I hate.
I don't want to eat
I've
it because of the
it.
Name.
I think it's just a texture thing. Almond Joys.
Yeah. Almond. I don't like almond.
I like
almonds.
Almond Joys. Mounds, not so much.
See, I don't like Almond Joy because of the.
Don't they have coconut?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
the coconut shavings and the Almond Joy. I don't know if texture wise.
I don't like how you say almond.
That could be a whole nother episode. So,
sorry.
While we're on the subject, hold on. Then there's Milky Way. Like Milky Way had.
I don't mind Milky Ways.
No,
Milky Ways
I like the caramel.
But then there's Three Musketeers.
And I like Milky Ways more than Three Musketeers.
I want I want more texture. That's why I always had issues with Milky Ways and Three Musketeers. They're both good in their own respect.
True.
But Snickers have like the peanuts and stuff.
We should do a random episode.
We're going to do a candy review episode.
March Madness. And we'll get all the.
Dude, we need to do March Madness.
Yeah. Actually, we should do that.
Chocolate, I'm down.
I mean, it's my birthday next weekend. Next weekend? Yeah, damn, next weekend. My birthday weekend.
38?
16. The 16th. Dude, we won't talk about how old I am.
Well, with that being said, I haven't even taken a sip yet. So
with that said, age-wise, they're releasing a 20-year,
yeah,
supposedly.
There you go.
So good.
There you go. All right, let me get the sip in.
Wow.
The second sip. Totally different than the first one.
The burn is almost like cinnamony.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense with the nose, because that's why I said like the burn is there, but it's not like an alcohol burn. It's almost like a spice burn.
Like a candy cinnamon burn.
You get that leather.
Mm-hmm.
Like that chewing on the first, belt, like a really old belt.
The first taste, like your first notes.
Yeah.
It's very crisp, clean, and sweet.
Yes.
I was gonna say, I'm gonna be honest with you, I didn't like the first sip.
Yeah.
I didn't like the mouthfeel of the first sip. Like, it was almost like it had too much oil in it. Like, it was too light.
Yes. But that's
why I said the second sip is completely different.
It's very light, but it's still complex.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I still get that caramel on the back end, but I get that leather, oaky, barn.
Like, when you think of a bourbon.
Like, Yellowstone feel.
That's what I'm saying. When you think of bourbon, that flavor, like that wood, leather, like just that
like
really
whoever's serving this to us should be behind the bar with a towel and some overalls,
black overalls,
and just cleaning a glass.
Yes,
I think that's what
with
it is.
With a big mustache.
Yep, yeah, with a big mustache.
I'm down with that.
And swingy doors.
Swing. what is it?
Like
barn doors.
Like
saloon doors.
Saloon doors.
Saloon doors.
Yeah.
Saloon
doors. Exactly. Saloon doors. Yes. Anyway,
yeah.
I can't get that.
And a spit can somewhere.
What's the sweet taste? I'm feeling a little rusty right now. What's that sweet taste in it?
I still get the toffee. Like, I get that. Like, it's like a dark. I keep going back to that dark chocolate.
It's more of a fruit.
But it's that toffee with that citrus.
It's more. Yeah, it's.
Like, not an orange, but an orange rind.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, like the.
Like,
the,
you get the. Like, it's a little bitter.
Like a kumquat.
I can honestly say I've never had
You've
a kumquat.
You've never had
before.
A kumquat?
I probably had a kumquat. Didn't know it was a kumquat.
Oh.
But at the same time, what a great
like
name
name,
for a what a great name for a vegetable.
Also sounds like something out of
the
Kama
Sutra. It's not a vegetable. It's a mini orange.
Yeah. Oh, it's a fruit.
Yeah, it's a little orange.
I thought those are cuties.
No. They're little. They're like
that small.
Yeah, they look like grape cherry tomatoes.
Oh,
really?
Yeah, but they're like an orange. Look, I mean,
where do you get them? Like, where do they grow? No, like, where do they grow?
I have no clue.
So
never heard.
We got
quat farm.
Oh, it gave me the nose. The nose. So the nose is complex. Aromas of toffee.
Ooh, got it.
Hints of orange peel.
Oh, yes.
Herbs, honey, leather, and oak.
Okay.
The taste is bold, dry, and delicate with notes of candied almonds.
Almonds.
And very rich.
Almonds.
It's not
Charlie,
the almond brothers.
Almonds.
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 The L doesn't exist in the Northeast.
So how do you pronounce the Almond Brothers?
Almond Brothers.
Almond Brothers. Because it's two L's. Almond Brothers. This is almonds. how do you say it?
Almonds.
Almonds?
Almonds?
Yes.
Just sounds like so much effort to say almonds.
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 Some Boston. My almonds.
Leave me alone. I think we're. It's funny because.
What was the tasting notes though besides dry?
It says
complex,
dry, delicate with notes of candied almonds, very rich cocoa.
Okay, so
and
there's
then
that
finishes dry.
Yeah, so it's that dark chocolate.
Yeah.
I think is what I'm getting.
Yep.
Like
I don't know. And maybe I'm not giving it enough credit. Just off of the first taste, I don't know how well this is going to open. I feel like...
The sweetness will come forward.
Yeah, it will? Okay.
Just by experience of me drinking multiple bottles of this, it will open.
Okay.
It will open.
All right. So let's go ahead and get into the topic for today's episode. And we're going to talk to you a little bit about like secondary property investment, then taking that in and difference between short-term, long-term rentals, that kind of stuff. So let's kind of take them through the experience. Oscar,
hold on.
They own their.
Oh. I
You found it?
Yeah, I kind of blocked you out. I don't know what you just said the last 5 minutes. Kumquat.
Ah.
For the viewers, it's a little mini orange.
That's an...
They're literally this big.
Why don't they just call it a mini orange?
The fuck?
They're little. They're like this big.
I've never had
that. That makes me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah. Wait.
Yeah, they're little tiny mini... You just eat them.
Huh.
Rind
them. Do you peel them?
It's like an orange with dwarfism.
Just eat them.
Like a monkey.
Yeah, they're like... They're the size of a grape. You don't peel them. I've never peeled them.
You just eat...
I mean, I don't eat them daily. I've had them like maybe 3 times in my life.
I was going to bowl of kumquats.
Yeah, I'm like going to come over. You want some kumquats? I'm just popping them in like chips.
He specializes in growing.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe you do peel them. I've had them like 2-3 times in my life.
Do you have any chips and salsa? No. I got a surprise for you, baby. I got kumquats.
They're like, do you like oranges? Do you like grapes? Do I have a surprise for you?
Perfect.
I mean, but they're very memorable. You'll know what they taste like. They're very potent, citrusy.
I love it. All right. So
kumquats, ladies and gentlemen.
Here we go.
I don't even know what talking about anymore.
All right. So basically, what we want to do. is I want to take it through kind of like you're thinking about buying a secondary property, whether that to be a vacation home. And let's be honest, that's where a lot of people think about buying secondary properties is vacation homes. So Oscar, what does that look like from a finance standpoint? What is different about buying a secondary property versus buying your home?
Everybody thinks, and you know, this is going to be a little bit of a miscellaneous real estate kind of episode, but everybody thinks that I'm going to buy a vacation home. I need to put 20% down because it's investment home, blah, blah, blah. Well, there's second homes. And for the longest time, I was under the impression that it had to be that you could live there as well as your primary home. And it had to be for work, right? Mm-hmm. So I did do some quick Q&A with a couple of my lenders. And they're like, well, you know, it doesn't really matter the distance, because I thought there was like a 100-mile radius or something like that from your original home.
Mm-hmm.
Not the case. I was told, and you know, your down payment's only 10%. So when you buy an investment home, it's usually 20%.
Okay.
So there's one of the financing is a lot easier. I don't want to say easier, but less stringent than, you know, if you're buying an investment home. But my big aha was, if you could buy a bunch of secondary homes, you know, you work remotely. You could say that, you know, you have business in these cool places.
So then, Oscar, let me ask, because in my mind, you know, to buy your first house, we have down payment assistance programs. We have all this kind of stuff. Is there anything set up for secondary properties like that? Or is the mindset more of, oh, you already own one, and if you can buy a secondary property, you don't really need that assistance?
I'm sure there's some stuff you can do similar. I don't think like 100% financing. Yeah. That probably is not going to fly, but as far as using it for, you know, your life,
yeah.
I mean, but then, you know, we're talking about short-term, long-term investments, right? Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could just buy it as your secondary home and then end up leasing it out.
Yeah.
I mean, that could be
a
hack.
Yeah.
I mean,
one thing that I do know about secondary properties is there are stipulations, especially in Colorado, around... When you're buying a secondary property, you have to have proof of like residency, that you live not 100 miles, but that you live near it. And you can't purchase it and then rent it immediately. Like
Correct.
You can't buy the house
Correct.
And then immediately list it for rent. There's like a grace period, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, suffer through the pains of paying two mortgages for about 2-3 months if you can.
I mean, what if you have family members that can occupy the dwelling for you, but you have mail sent there?
And that's one thing. So one of the biggest, back in the day when there was a lot of HUD homes,
mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of people would buy them and then, you know, they don't really follow up on you. But when it was a HUD home, there was a lot of eyes on it. Like if you went in there and then use it as a rental or right away leased it, they would crack down on you, and that's a federal offense, right? When you do an FHA loan, yes, you're not supposed to, you know, down payment assistance and then lease it as an investment property. If you have just one, there's not going to be a lot of eyes on you. Is it ethical? Probably not. But the only way they can tell is if you have multiple, a lender's not going to give you two FHA loans,
mm-hmm.
right? So with that said, if you have a secondary home, I don't know what the criteria would be of someone coming down and saying, hey, you're not living in this property. I mean, how are they going to prove it, right? Mm-hmm. Ethically, you don't really want to do that. But, you know.
There are things that, there are ways to manage it if you want to buy that, that secondary property.
Yeah. I mean, I think the important, if we want to start the conversation, the important thing to understand is as somebody looking to invest in real estate, you want to really, really clarify your goals.
Yes.
Right. Because as we've talked about, there's second homes, there's short term versus long term, there's vacation rentals, so on and so forth. But if you don't have a clear picture of like what the goal is, then it's very hard to even get started. And well, when I say what the goal is, I mean, for example, let's say you want cash flow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Or if you don't want cash flow, you want appreciation on the home value.
Yeah.
Or if you are looking at a vacation home, is it a vacation home that you want to be able to enjoy occasionally? Or is it something that you want completely hands off, so on and so forth? Because it's going to change your, what do I say, your strategy on how you're going to invest in those different types of properties.
And that's what I was going to say, though, is there's, it's funny because we've been saying like a vacation home, right? And there's, I want to make the distinction, there's a difference between an investment property.
Mm-hmm.
And a vacation home, like a significant...
And a second home.
And a second home. A significant difference between those. Yes, they're all secondary properties, like the second place that you're going to buy. But a vacation home doesn't have, like with Jameson, cash flow. So when you buy that vacation home, you have to understand that you're going to be paying a second mortgage and you're only going to be living there for a month, 2 months, weeks at a time. So like that's something that you have to consider is, am I going to make this investment in a property and then let it sit and not have cash flow
and
on it?
And that's how... the birth of the dreaded, what are they called? They come at you and they sell a timeshare.
Timeshare, yeah.
Right, because you're, I don't know what your average American, I guess, will vacation X amount of times and then you spend this money and then you buy a timeshare and you have partial ownership. Well, again, miscellaneous real estate, there is partial ownership here in Colorado in the mountains that you and maybe four other people own a quarter deed of a property. And they use it a certain amount a year. So that's when vacations get kind of weird, right?
Absolutely. And
I don't know, what's your take on it? How do you feel, both of you, as just a consumer and as a real estate agent and personally about one, timeshare, and two, partial deeded ownership?
I think timeshares work for certain situations, especially. So Alicia's dad, he plays pool. He's a professional pool player. So he travels to Vegas regularly for the tournaments and stuff like that. And for him, I think it's a phenomenal option to have a timeshare because he can say, you know, I have part ownership. I have a place that I can stay when I need to go there, but I don't have to worry about the full cost of it, the full brunt. And he's as far in the, you know, 3.5 years that I've been in the family, he's never really had a problem with with the timeshare, where most problems you see with timeshares, like you were saying, is I want to go. Oh, well, I want to go.
Mm-hmm.
What are my time frames? When can I go? You literally have other people that you have to coordinate around. When it comes to like secondary properties, I don't know. Maybe this is the hippie in me. I think that there should be a limit to the amount of properties that you can own with certain stipulations, right? And only because we do have such a shortage in homes. And a lot of people are saying, oh, well, BlackRock comes in and buys this many, or Blackstone, whatever it is, and buys up these houses and makes them rentals. And it's, from the report that I saw recently, it was something like 21% of individuals that own 10%, like 10 homes or less, are the ones that are buying up the properties, which would be considered an individual investor, you know, like you or I going to buy and having this portfolio versus like somebody developing a community, right? Like home builders. So I don't know. It's weird. Like I don't think that I've experienced enough of life and monetary freedom to see the benefit of like owning multiple properties, if I'm being honest with you. So to me, it still comes off as a little greedy if you own more than, you know, let's say two or three homes. But again, I haven't experienced that yet. I don't really understand and know what that looks like investment-wise, passive income and stuff like that. So that's kind of where I'm sitting.
Well, let's take a look at it this way then. I'm just going to play Oscar's role, devil's advocate. Rents increase and home prices increase because of supply and demand, right? And if you take a look at most of the mom-and-pop developers and house flippers and investors, they are going into areas that are usually underserved and they're going in and they are renovating homes that they are now allowed to rent out to individuals that are looking to rent, and do it at a cost that is not astronomically high. Because if you're BlackRock or somebody, right, and you're going in and buying these batches of homes,
you're in for profit
and you're doing it in areas that have higher home values. Mm-hmm. The mom and pop investors, because they're doing fix and flips and they're on a more constrained budget, they need to look at the lower end of the inventory as far as price and condition. So if you take those people out and you still have those, don't want to call them dilapidated, but stressed houses, and nobody's going in to renovate them, but you have large companies going in and buying an entire tract of land, putting a Century Homes community on it that starts at 600,000, and not renting those out or renting them out at a really, really elevated cost, you're not allowing renters that need the homes access to the homes in the areas that they can afford. Does that make sense?
So basically what you're saying is mom and pop investors, the people who do own 10 or less, they're helping the community because they're not going
to... They're contributing to the supply.
Okay.
Which is what we need.
Right.
And they're contributing to the supply at a price point that most people that need to rent have to look anyway.
But again, we're talking, I think now we're getting out of the realm though of like secondary property for short-term rentals, because it's basically, you're talking specifically about fix and flips. Like if they're fixing and flipping, not holding on to that as a short or long-term.
Well, no, you can fix it, right? And rehab it and then rent it out as a long-term rental.
To piggyback on what he's saying, there is people that do it out of just, hey, we're going to help out. I was involved in a transaction where, and I don't know if they want me to share their names, but they're friends of mine from school, both of them. I played baseball with the husband, and they were offered Regis, the college, was going to let go of a lot of their land. They owned a lot of land over in North Denver, and they started selling it to first their employees. She worked for Regis at their price, which is not market. It was below market. And they were buying it as an investment, and we took a look at it, and we put it together. It was not traditional real estate because there was a lot of legality how they were doing it, because you're not really supposed to do something like that legally. So it was a commercial lender that took care of the Regis side of it. But they bought it to rent it to not quote-unquote low-income, but someone that would need it. She didn't want to make a profit. Like, she didn't want to get rich off of it. Mm-hmm. He wanted to start his investment portfolio, but she was very adamant, the wife, we're going to rent it at or below market rents. We're not doing it for profit. We're doing it to help the community, because it is in North Denver. That's where they live.
Got it.
So they were like, we're going to rent it out to someone that's deserving and needs it, and we're not going to gouge it on it. As long as it pays the mortgage, that we're okay with that. So, you know, there's people that go out there and do that too.
Yeah.
In the long run, it will be their retirement. Yeah. When they need to, but they're helping the community.
The low volume renters will go in, and they are the ones that are going into these displaced communities, and they're buying these properties and they're fixing them up to rent, right? Like, that's just what they're doing. So I do think that they, even if they have 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 single family homes, they are contributing to the supply to continue to keep rents under control.
Got it.
Versus if they don't do that, then you either just take supply away, which now obviously cost goes up, or you have somebody come in, scrape it like they do. You know, you go down anywhere in, I don't know what, off of 6th in Colorado, right? Mm-hmm. And you'll see cottage, mid-century farmhouse with a black tin roof. Mm-hmm. That's $3.5 million. Like, who is that serving, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's the case. But again, when we're talking from an investment standpoint, that's why it's important to clarify what your goals are. Because if you go into and let's say you want a long-term investment on a house, right? Well, you're going to get one of two things. You're very rarely going to get both. You're either going to get appreciation that's going to outstrip the market appreciation in the area, or you're going to get cash flow. But you're not going to get both.
Let me ask you one thing, both of you. Where do you draw the line, or what is considered neighborhood improvement, and when does it turn into gentrification?
Gentrification, I think...
Is it a term that just got a bad rap?
I think gentrification turns into when the affordability in that specific area gets out of whack based on the home values that are coming
in. So it's a fine line to where you clean it up enough to where it just takes off.
It's also
And where do you want to keep it, and why do we want to keep it? It's kind of a weird scenario, right?
And I think gentrification is it's it's gotten a bad rap only because it increases the cost of living in the area. Like, in my mind, that's what gentrification means, is so many businesses, companies threw money into this area that the people who were living here now cannot afford to live here as they did before this. They came in and gentrified. And I mean, South Park has a beautiful example of that. It's like a 3-episode stint. But I think that for me is, it has to be, if you're bringing higher level homes, if you're making the cost more effective, then the job market has to follow, the pay has to follow. And if it doesn't, that's when you see the negative side of gentrification, of we're just making this more expensive, and now the people who could afford it before can't afford it now.
Well, that's, I mean, gentrification is the PC term.
Yeah.
Essentially, you're displacing people.
Yes.
Is what it is, right? Mm-hmm. And again, is it all their fault? No, right? The money's going to flow where the money's going to, where it's going to, where the people are going to get
Highlands.
More money.
Again, free North market. Denver Highlands.
Right. But but it will displace those individuals. And to your question, Oscar, it's a very, wouldn't say it's a fine line. I think it's more of a delicate balance.
Yeah.
Because you want to go in and have community improvements, but community improvements require increase in taxes. If most things are funded by property taxes, you need increase in home values. In order to increase in home values, you have to go in and buy more expensive homes. People aren't going to move into more expensive homes unless the businesses and the economics mm-hmm. justify them going into that space. So it's this weird balance and cycle where you have to have, you know, that balance of, okay, we're going to improve the neighborhood and we're going to bring in more expensive homes, but we're also going to keep areas that are affordable. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. The problem is building affordable housing, like we've talked about forever, is just not profitable for the most part. Right. So that's what I'm saying. I think it depends on your goal.
I think, and this just came to thought, I think it might be a generational thing too. For the most part, you know, the term, you know, homeowner occupant is not going to have the pride of ownership. I think that's kind of gone away, just because if you look at the renters in certain communities, there are renters, but it's a beautiful community.
Well, and not only that, I think it's also changed in an element where, to your point, it's, you know, it used to be buy a house, stay there, white picket fence, raise the family. But I think culture has switched in a way now where renting is better for some people's lifestyles. And when they're 100%. Ready to purchase, they can. But, you know, like, I have friends that are more nomadic than anything. They travel state to state. They do ski resorts. Then they go down and they bartend in the Keys, and renting works for them because that's their lifestyle. So I do think that, to your point, it has shifted generationally, as of course you see more younger millennials and Gen Zers prioritizing experience over investment. And I do think that that's where the rental market is seeing more of a revival. In short-term and long-term rentals, specifically because people are willing to move around more and owning that piece of property isn't as important. And let's be honest, owning property does come with more than just a mortgage, homeowners insurance, stuff. Like, you have upkeep, you have your lawn, you have all the stuff that goes into it. So when we're at a point in the United States where it's been the most expensive to live in the U.S. as it's ever been in U.S. history, but people are prioritizing experiences over profit, I do think that is why the rental market is more appealing to investors, but then also home, you know, to renters in general.
So what's the difference between, just to kind of go over it and bring it back, short-term versus, like, investing in short-term rental versus investing in a long-term rental?
So,
like, fundamentally, what are the differences?
I think one of the biggest differences is profit margin mm-hmm. and risk.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
When you're going long-term, you know, you have a renter for a full year. You have
so hold on, Oscar. Before we go into it, I want to kind of
define it. Yeah.
Short-term, long-term rental. So when we say short-term rentals, what we're talking about, Airbnb, VRBO, vacation rentals, those areas where you're going to go and you're going to rent a place for 4 days.
Well, you own the home.
Yes.
And your clientele is renting it for a short amount of time.
Less than 60 days is considered short term.
Yeah. Yep. And then long term rentals is what you standard think of apartments, townhomes, condos, rent that will be elongated 6 months to 12 months contract beyond, leasing basis.
Yep.
Well, and it's the lease term mm-hmm. because you could do a short term on a house.
Yes.
You mm-hmm. know, there's VRBOs.
But again, and that's what I mean. But it comes down to the owner of the home. And you can do, I mean, I've seen people rent an Airbnb for 3 months, 6 months at a time, mm-hmm. but then you're just using Airbnb as the platform to do a longer term rental, right?
Right. So if that's what the if
traveling
that's,
nurses,
if that's the fundamental difference, then from the standpoint of somebody that's looking to potentially get into real estate investing, why would somebody do one over the other? Or what are some of the pitfalls,
I think,
right?
I think you make a lot more money, higher risk with short term.
Okay.
Because if you, let's say you have a condo in up in Vail, you do short term VRBOs, you know, it's very seasonal and you're gonna make a ton of money during that time, but then it's seasonal, but you can still do that in Denver. It's going to be a little seasonal because you're going to rely on conventions and then you're going to be booked out. I think that might be a little more consistent because there's more going on in the city, you know, people traveling, a lot of tourism. With that, same with Vail, but in the summer, you're not probably going to get as much traffic. But you're going to get, let's say that you make, I don't know, $6,000 a month with the short term. And then if you take that same condo and you do long term, you're only going to be charging standard rate rent, which will be, I don't know, maybe $2,200 a month.
Okay.
So there's a big difference, but you got to look at it in the long term with both. You have your long-term rental, which will, you know, net you X amount a year, and then your short-term might be the same.
Well,
because
I think,
of the off-season.
And I think from the owner,
but if it's not, it might be a little bit more.
From an investor owner's perspective, I know for me, a short-term rental would be, doing short-term rentals would be more appealing if I then owned that property in a place that I enjoy going to. And this is where I bring
it. Off-season, you go stay there.
Exactly. That's where I bring it back to, you know, if you're making an investment on a secondary property, that person that's saying, oh, this is my vacation home, they go there maybe 2 to 3 months out of the year, but then they're just paying mortgage. They're losing money for 6 to 8 months of the year. So I think that short-term rentals are a lot more appealing to somebody who is going to go, you know what, I would love to own property in this area, but I don't, but I want to make money on it. I don't want to throw money at it.
And the difference is, we've had this conversation at home, is so if you're going to do a short-term rental, you can't fall in love with it or the stuff inside because other people are going to use it. So you're like, it's mine, but it's really not, you know, it's an investment. If I have a vacation home that I just want to use, it's my stuff, and you know, you take the loss and you take the hit, you really don't rent that out. So that's the biggest thing, is the emotional attachment to the property.
Well, and I think
when it's your vacation or it's investment vacation.
Well, you said it before, is the risk versus profit, right?
Right.
And I think that comes from, I know I've been in Airbnb, I've stayed at Airbnbs where they've said, hey, we need an extra, you know, 4 hours to clean at the group before you kind of destroyed the place. And I think to your point, that's exactly that. It's not, when Oscar says risk, when you have people staying in your homes, they could steal a TV, they could break a TV, they could break a bed. It's a lot more management upfront cost with short term rentals. You got to clean it, pay for the. I mean, we all know what's been going on with that Airbnb's cleaning fees. You know, some people are charging fucking $400 and then they expect you to take out the trash.
That guy that threw that big party that just crushed the floor.
Mm-hmm.
That's insane.
Yeah. But that's what Oscar means when he's talking about risk with short-term versus long-term. When you have a tenant in there, you actually tend to build a relationship with your tenants.
How much background check do they do on you when you do short-term?
Little to none. Sign it into an app. Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
So when you do long-term, you do some. You know, sometimes they do a criminal background, they do a credit background. And not necessarily your credit score is going to get you it, but they'll see. They're looking for that you pay stuff on time.
Yeah.
You could have a trash credit score and still get a house, a rental. So they do a little bit more, and then maybe the interview process, you know, and you get someone nice, they're going to take care of your stuff long term.
Yeah. Well,
it's their home and it's pride of living there.
And with a long term rental, I think there's a mindset for people who are staying in there that's completely different than short term. Short term, people are usually going there to party. They're going to have alcohol. They're going to have a bunch of friends there. Long term, that's their home. Like you're saying, like they take pride in actually living there.
Correct.
And a big difference between short term and long term for me is, long term, because there's less risk and less investment over time, obviously you got to do regular upkeep, and we always hear about landlord specials, but I think you're relying more on equity growth with long term than you are with short term.
Yes. So here's the other caveat. When you are looking at, okay, let's say I've decided short term is the way I want to go. I want to buy something that I can turn into an Airbnb, and I want to turn a profit, right? Because if you're going to short term, to your point, yeah, you'll get the appreciation, right? Just because everything appreciates in real estate, but you're looking for cash flow.
Yep.
You're not looking for the appreciation. You're looking for, hey, my mortgage is X amount. I want to make 30% on top of that, whatever, right? But the difference is, if you want a profitable short-term property that has the potential for success in Airbnb, VRBO, or whatever it is, where are those areas usually located?
In
tourism high, or big cities.
Tourism, dense areas.
And what does that mean for the home prices that you're looking at?
High.
Right.
And, I love it. I love that you were going that direction, because that's exactly what I was going to say is it's almost the nature of short-term rentals to be profit-driven, because you're not going to go to these dilapidated places where it's 35 minutes away from a
I'm not having an Airbnb in Commerce City.
You're not going to do a VRBO in Hugo, right? Colorado?
Or Reunion.
I mean, you know, elk hunting out your backyard, why not?
Pheasant hunting.
It's a very niche
market.
But yes,
that is where you want to look, is because you're going, okay, well, I can make a profit here. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to say the two areas that everybody thinks about immediately when we talk about
ski.
Okay, we'll go three. Is Arizona, ski towns, and Florida.
Yep.
Right? Mm-hmm. So if you go to Arizona right now, part of the reason, even though there's astronomical run-up in home prices, part of the reason they're not seeing a massive decline is because so many people golf year-round, and they want to be in Arizona for 6 months out of the year when it's 80 degrees and sunny, when we're at -2 and 60-mile-an-hour winds, right? Mm-hmm. But because of that, if you go and buy something in and around Phoenix, Gilbert, Scottsdale, wherever that is, Flagstaff, you're going to pay a premium on the home price, which now means, okay, well, I'm going to make a profit. I
got to make more money fast.
But my mortgage might double. So instead of paying $3,000 a month,
houses are beautiful,
I'm paying $6,000 a month.
Mesa,
right?
Man.
Exactly. But now you got to, because you're an Airbnb or a VRBO, and let's say you're out of state, now you have to look at property management companies, and you have to start paying a cut to them, because you don't want to be the one that's got to find all these different vendors to do the cleanup and to do the maintenance and to take care of the pool and do all these different things. So now that goes into the perform of, do I want to actually invest, right? So that's why I'm saying it's a very, you want to have a very specific goal, because if you do long-term, and you say, I want, you know, a single family home that I can rent out to people for a year, 2 years, whatever it is, just know that that's not going to replace your 9-to-5 income, right? Mm-hmm. It won't. It's going to give you cash flow. It's going to have somebody paying down that.
What did
I say
about 5 years? 5 years in, you'll start really reaping the benefits.
So that being said, and I want Oscar to touch on this, because he's done these, and he's done these multiple times. Part of defining your goals from an investment standpoint is working numbers and figuring out financially what makes sense. So Oscar, if you don't mind, can you go through what a performa is in relation to looking to purchase an investment property?
So a performa is what you're pretty much the budget going into an investment property. You're gonna have cap rates, what's the percentage of what you're going to make on what you invest, your cash on cash return. Cap rate is net operating income divided by property asset value. You know, a lot of the investors that I talk to want a cap rate of 6.5+.
What does that mean?
That means when you do your net operating income on what they're going to bring in comparison to what they're putting down in their acquisition costs is. So 6%, 6.5% cap rate is a good investment for them. Plus, you know, if they could see it in the 13th, 14th, that's great. You know, that means you're getting more money. But I was going through my quick numbers. Caught me a little off guard, because I was looking through my old notes.
Okay.
Because we did have a percentage on what you should set aside for maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the way you do that is, you know, you got to come in, you got to look at what the age of your roof is, your furnaces, your water heater, when you're going to start having to replace that. And then you calculate how long and, or if you have to do it tomorrow, what's that going to cost you? And then you incorporate that into the rents, and it'll go into an account and accumulate. So when it's done, you're ready for it, and it doesn't catch you, you know, off guard. And then, you know, you're paying more money into it. That's on top of where you're going to pay an asset management company. I don't know how much they're charging these days. I haven't talked to a good
10%.
Is it 10% now? Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, your wife is in that. So you know, you calculate 10% of what of the rent that you're going to pay them, which is well worth it, because it could be a headache. You know, they take care of keeping it rented, marketing it.
Contracts.
Do they do the
lease,
the credit checks, and all that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they take care of a lot. And believe it or not, it is a lot.
It's a lot.
And it's very cumbersome. Unless you are a master at Excel and you like going through that, it's well worth every dime.
So let's do kind of like a mock, just quick. If you're gonna invest in a home, so Jameson, I see you looking at some stuff.
Well, no, so let's take, I don't know, let's say it's a $450,000 house, single family home, okay? Oscar, just off the top of your head, what do you think market rent is for a $450,000 home in Denver Metro?
Denver Metro, 3-2. Mm-hmm. Let's call it $3,200.
Okay, so $3,200 in rent, right? Now, you just talked about it. Your cap expenses, how much do you withhold per year to make sure that you can deal with maintenance issues, a blown AC?
That's what I was looking for. I mean,
normally it's like 10%, right? 10% a year off your gross rent.
That would be
roughly close.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's say
good standard to go.
Yeah. So let's say $3,200 a month is what you're grossing in rent. And then you want to hold back so you times it by 12. So your gross rent's $38,000, right? That's what you're collecting. Now you're going to want to take 10% of that and put it to the side every single year. So let's call it $4,000, mm-hmm. right? So if I take $4,000 out of that, now I'm at my gross is $34,400. That's how much I'm making total in rent when I take out my expenses just for market or for maintenance, right? Maintenance. So what other expenses do you take out of your rent?
We'll do another. Would you take another 10% out for the management company?
Depends. You could.
So yeah. I mean, obviously you have your. Your payment's going to have your taxes, your yep. insurance. So utilities.
Okay.
Depends on, you know.
Your agreement, right?
Yeah. I mean, you have Excel, gas. That might be in the HOAs already if you have an HOA. If it's a house.
Internet.
Internet.
Well, let's say your property management company's 12%.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. They take and they take
so
care of all
your
that.
Gross rents, 12% of $38,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's $4,500. So now we've got $34,500 minus another $4,500. So now my gross rent for the year is $30,000 on this $450,000 house.
And then I'd like to check these numbers because I had a 3% vacancy.
Sure.
You have to put that in.
Yep.
Okay.
So, you know, that's a loss.
And 3% on what, 12 months, let's say?
Yeah.
So what is that? 97%. So it's 97% occupancy rate. So $38,500 times 0.97. So now I'm at 37,000. So that's what you bank on, mm-hmm. saying that your home's going to be unoccupied 3% of the time. Minus the 4,500, minus the 4,500. So now you're at 28,345 is your gross rent after your expenses. Mm-hmm. So you take that number and you divide it by whatever the market value of the home is. So let's say the market value is 450,000.
Property asset value.
Right? So 450,000, which means you come up with a cap rate of about 6.3%.
So,
not bad.
No,
not right? Bad. Not bad. The other way you can do it, and Oscar alluded to it, is you can take how much you invested in the property, so the down payment, versus the rent that you're getting, and that's going to give you your cash on cash return, right? So essentially you want to say, yes, I'm financing, you know, so we just said it's what, 20% for an investment property minimum. Yep. Mm-hmm. So that's $90,000. Well, if I invested $90,000 and my gross rent we just said it's 28, right?
So 28 divided by
28,500 divided by 90,000
should be higher.
Cash on cash return is about 3.1%.
3.1%?
Mm-hmm. Which is not great, right? No. You want to be, you kind of want to be,
you want your cash on cash to be higher than your cap rate.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. You want to be at least 6, if not higher. So you want your cap rate over 6, you want your cash on cash return. These are all calculators you guys can find online.
Very
well.
Easily.
But it gives you an idea because a lot of people, and the reason I think this is an important conversation to have, a lot of people will go, well, this house is $250,000. I'm going to buy it because it's cheap and I'm going to make mm-hmm. money. It's not that simple.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. So, Oscar, I know I caught you off guard, but when you say performa and you look at the numbers, I know obviously cap rate is one of them, but as an investor, somebody who's purchased investment property, with that performa, what are the things you're looking for to see if it makes sense on paper as far as financials go?
Typically, when I'm doing a performa, it's multi-unit. For example, the one that I did down in Sunnyside, mm-hmm. I had to do acquisition, build out and all of that, and then what it was going to do projected out, right? So I had to calculate in the incomes, which were, I had to, every unit sold,
yep.
what the market rate was going to do, real estate fees. I put 1% for concessions, hold cost, acquisitions, and everything. So you're projecting numbers, how it's going to benefit you.
Yep.
Right? With it's called offer memorandum, an OM. You're getting everything up front. So that's going to have rent rolls, how much you're renting, utilities, your net operating expenses, and net operating incomes. And then you start building out your pro forma from there.
Well, and I think
moving forward,
that
if rents will go high or go up in projected
cap rates and stuff. I think you mentioned something. You said it, though, is there are investments that are long-term, but there you also have multiple streams of rent, multiple streams of income from that one. And that's where you get into that house hacking idea where you're going to buy a duplex, you're going to live in one side and then rent out the other, and that other side of the rent is going to supplement yours. That, I think, is a whole nother realm of investment than kind of that short-term versus long-term secondary property. Because if you have somebody that's looking, and I think this breaks down to kind of where we've been going of, I want to buy a secondary property. I want that to be my vacation home that I stay in. I want to have it as a short-term rental so I can make something on it. Or I just want to have a long-term tenant in there that is going to, you know, just, I'm going to sit and I'm going to gain value on the equity of the home
over
time.
So back to where Jameson was alluding to this, I think a pro forma would be more enact to do a deep dive on short-term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. you're going to have more variables like vacancies, seasonality, and, you know, price increases during that time.
Yep.
Then a long-term, I think a long-term pro forma is simple. What's your net operating income?
Exactly.
What's your net operating expense? There you have it. That's mm-hmm. pretty cut and dry.
Mm-hmm.
And then because obviously market rents are going to go up and down, but they're further along, like a year or so. They're not, you know, month to month, like on a short term. If you get like hot convention season, which is what, March, yep. February, whatever, in town, you're probably going to hike the rents up a little bit and
correct.
Go with the hotels. And then during the off season, you're going to bring them down. Same with the ski season. During the winter, your rents are going to be way high. And during the summer, your rents are going to be way low. So with the long term, your rent's going to be fixed for 6 months to a year, and then you reevaluate the rents the following year. If they want to re-sign the lease, you know, have that conversation with them, or you keep it the same
mm-hmm.
for that because he was a good renter.
Well, and here's a great example.
You cut your risk yeah. at that point.
And here's a great example from a long term standpoint why we say like yeah, it's not going to replace your 9-to-5 income. So that same example, the 450.
It can if you do a lot of them.
Correct.
Well, that's exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. Is we just said that you're going to make
but
an extra $28,000
house, mm-hmm. right? 3-bed, 2-bath, and you put 20% down. Sometimes 25. Just depends on yep. what the lender is. So let's say you put 25% down, right, just to get your monthly payment. Now you're investing that. You're investing $115,000.
Mm-hmm.
Your mortgage payment on that, so your PITI, principal, interest, tax, insurance, is around for 25% down, it's about $2,900 a month. We just said you can rent it for maybe $3,200. So mm-hmm. your cash flow before any expenses is $300.
Monthly.
After expenses, you're probably closer to about $100 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to replace? No, you're making $1,200 a year.
So the way you look at that from a straight investment point of view is how much money? 100 down payment?
We'll go
20%.
We'll go 20% to $90,000.
$90,000. How much is $90,000 going to save in the safest bet, which is money market?
Press CD at this point at 5%. Yeah.
Like safe. 4%. It's going to, how much are you going to get on that annually?
Right.
Because that's how they calculate it.
Yep.
Break it down. And then how much is that $90,000 going to acquire monthly? The catch is you got to factor in appreciation
yes.
and tax depreciation. Mm-hmm. So it's a better bet because you're going to make monthly income.
Correct.
It's going to be higher percentage.
Yes.
You're going to add your appreciation of value and your depreciation of taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where you have to understand and or talk to someone that could explain that to you.
Correct.
Not just, hey, buy this property. You're going to make $100 a month. I don't know if I want to. What if I need my $90,000?
Well, no,
and you could always lend against it and get your
yes.
$90,000 out.
Yes. Well, no, and I think this is a good place to kind of tie it in for the One Rock takeaway because it's I fear that the media and the just the social media of it all, the information that's out there, has made real estate investing into this goose egg, this golden egg, mm-hmm. where you're going to invest, you buy real estate and then rent it because you're going to make so much money. And I think that if we can move into the One Rock takeaway.
Well, before we go that really, 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 really fast, because we didn't touch on this, and this was kind of where I was going to structure everything. But I'm glad you said it, because you hit it the nail on the head. It's an elusive golden egg that it's unattainable. Well, there's now DSCR loans that might make sense. You can use those rents. If you have the money, you can use those rents to offset, you know, your qualifications.
So can you DS?
Debt service coverage ratio. So you can use the rents that you're potentially going to get to cover the to qualify for the mortgage of this property.
Oh, that's scary though. That's taking a. The only reason I say that is in my mind, it's, you know, the Jay-Z, if you can't afford it, if you can't buy it twice, kind of thing. So taking out the loan based specifically on what the opportunity of rent could be, especially in such a volatile market like real estate in general, that to me would be scary, because I'd be saying, basically, I'm guaranteeing this payment based off of this rent. But what if, like in Denver specifically right now, but between 2024 and 2025, they're seeing an increase of 24% inventory in rental opportunities. Correct.
So these programs mm-hmm. are typically for your investor that's leveraged and he's like, I know I could make this. I know I could make it happen. He needs an extra help with the qualifications. For example, you have a bunch of them. You know it can happen. You know mm-hmm. what you're doing. You're going to take consideration that risk. But your income doesn't, I mean, you're tapped out.
Well, and I think it just goes
into
it.
And these are non-QM.
Like, well, I think it goes into it. To any level of investment, whether it's real estate, stocks, shoes, whatever you consider an investment, Pokemon cards, there is a level of risk that you have to be okay with before making that leap and being an investor in anything, no matter what it is. And I think for me, that's kind of...
Yeah, you buy that first card, next thing you know, you got to catch them all.
Yeah.
Well, the...
spending 20 grand on a card.
The DSCR loans, just to kind of simplify it, right? Essentially, it's very easy to calculate. So if you guys are looking at like, hey, you know what? What is it? Is it even worth looking at? It's a very simple formula. All it is is the monthly rental income, so gross rental income, divided by your PITI, your HOA, and that's it. And property taxes, right? So that's it's just PITI, HOA. So essentially, in our example that we've used, $450,000 house, if you wanted to buy that and use a DSCR loan, you would say, okay, I'm gonna charge $3,200 a month. My mortgage is, with 20% down, $3,000 a month. All they look at is the ratio. And if the ratio is one or above, you qualify. So in that scenario, let's just, for the listeners and viewers out there, you take your monthly rent, $3,200, you divide it by $3,095, which is what the PITI was, $3,095, you are at a 1.03, which means you would then qualify. You have to prove that that's the rental income, that's what it's going to be. But as long as you're above that ratio, then you qualify. You can get farther above that ratio with a larger down payment. So if you go from 20% to 25% on that same loan, now you go from a 1.03 to like a 1.1, which gives you a break on the interest rate, but it allows you to do that. So that's what that looks like. And they don't require personal income.
Wow.
Because again, but it makes sense.
You're leveraging against the rental income. And if you already have the money to purchase the property with that down payment, then
And the reason I bring that up is because you said, wow, that's scary.
Yeah.
It's really not, because they're saying, okay, you have to at least have 20% down. Mm-hmm. You have to at least prove that your market rent's $3,200.
So,
and we know what your mortgage is going to be based on that down payment. So we're good.
Yeah.
It's easier, believe it or not. Well, I don't want to say easier, but if you could put the deal together, you got a rental property.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's harder for you to qualify to buy your own house mm-hmm. if you have the cash for it. And the way that I explain to buyers is that you're telling the bank a story. This is my credit. That means I've paid stuff on time. This is how much money I make and they would, and 50% of that could only go to the mortgage. And, you know, interest rates for the longest times were a risk factor, right? The higher the risk, the higher the interest rate. So a bank is more willing to let you borrow money. If I come to you and say, hey, Charlie, let me borrow $500,000. Well, you don't know me. Well, here's my story. How much are you putting down? Nothing. All right.
Yeah.
I'm a bit of a liability,
yeah.
You know, because then you're going to get stuck with the property. But if I come back and I say, Charlie, let me borrow $500,000. Okay, here's my story. It looks good. How much skin in the game do you have? Well, I'm going to put 20% down. Yep. I'm less likely to walk away from my 20% than if I bought the house for $100,000.
Absolutely.
Or to Oscar's point.
For $1,000.
Same scenario. Let's say you do find a lender that will allow a 10% down payment for a secondary property, right? Well, the DSCR loan won't allow that because if you put 10% down on that same property, your mortgage payment is $3,500 a month. You divide that by the $3,200 that you're charging in rent, you're under that one factor, which mm-hmm. means you now know you can't qualify, mm-hmm. right? So it is actually more, it sounds crazy.
It's more structure in place.
But there's a lot more structure and fail-safes in place, and it allows people, as long as they have $90,000. Like if I got $90,000 and I'm telling that same story to the bank, they're going to be like, yo, high five, bro.
Here you go. Yeah. Love it. Congratulations. Yeah. You got it.
Good finding that deal.
So,
yeah.
You know? No, I agree.
No, and everybody makes, the bank's in it for money.
Yeah, it's like, profit.
Yeah, it's profit. So they want you to profit. Have it. That's what I understand a lot of these underwriters, right? Yeah. We're always griping about them. Damn underwriter. You got two kind of underwriters. You got the underwriters trying to get you to the table, and you got the underwriters trying to kill the deal. Mm-hmm. The ones that are trying to kill the deal, it's like, what are you doing? It's not your money. Don't take it personal. Second of all, the bank is paying you to invest their money to make money.
Mm-hmm. Make money.
Make them
show
money.
Show me the money.
Damn it.
Make them money. I love it. All right. So I think let's go ahead and move into the One Rock takeaway.
You take it first, hippie.
Yeah, I'm taking it first. So my One Rock takeaway.
Cut those sideburns, hippie.
Right? My One Rock takeaway for today's episode is I'm just going to pull straight from what JMO said during the episode. If you're looking to invest, make sure you have a plan. Do not get blindsided and or too excited about the opportunity of having a secondary property to invest in it. Actually have a plan. Know what you want to do. If you want to use it as a vacation rental, make sure that you can afford covering that and there's nobody living there monthly. If you want to make profit on it, plan your short-term rental. Do the research necessary to find out what you're going to make from that. And see if the net sheet works. See if the investment is going to make you enough money and you're okay with putting out those costs in order to make that amount of money per month. From the hippie standpoint, I don't know. It's hard for me because if I have 90 grand to put down on an investment, in my mindset now and how I am now, I'd probably use that 90 grand to go on a trip and do something and then use the other half of that, $45,000 to
I'm going to say that's going to be a hell of a trip.
I'm just saying.
I'm saying go buy an Airbnb in Ireland.
Yes.
And then you and Alicia have a vacation spot when you guys want to revisit where you got engaged.
Yeah.
Just throwing it out there.
You're right.
I mean, to add to what you're saying, have a goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's the goal? And let us figure it out.
Yeah.
My goal is X. Well, here are the scenarios. And then once you do it once, then you don't have to restructure every time. This is what I want, and these are the numbers. Then we find the house that fit those numbers.
No, honestly, Oscar, I love that because bringing it back to the fact that we say it all the time, there's specialists for a reason. There's realtors mm-hmm. for a reason. There's people who know these markets for a reason. Lean on them, especially in investment ideas.
Yep.
I like it.
And you know, I do mountain communities, and it's real estate's real estate on paper at the end of the day. But there's the nuances like topography and stuff like that, marketability. But I got hit with one this morning that I had no clue the ins and outs of a leach field.
Hmm.
That's important to know.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know how a septic tank works, but they didn't certify the leach field because of the moisture in 2 weeks. So I was like, how do you fix that? I need to find out.
Well,
I've never come across not being able to certify it. Because usually the buyer takes care of it beforehand. And then we're not supposed to be experts in the mechanics of the home, but we should know.
Yeah. 100%.
And that's when, same as this, a specialist would come in handy.
100%. JMO?
So I wrote these down, but I'm gonna go with my One Rock takeaway is the 10 reasons I think, and the world thinks, the smart people than me, to invest in real estate. And we're just going to go through the list.
Go for it.
Right? Number one, diversification. Diversify your investment portfolio. Super simple. Number two, it's an inflation hedge, right?
homes appreciate. They've doubled every 10 years since 1950. It's an inflation hedge. Three, intuitiveness. People want to invest in things they're comfortable with. If you're a homeowner, you're comfortable with how the housing market works. So it's not like you're investing in Bitcoin or gold or treasury yields or foreign assets. Like, you know your home, your neighborhood.
It's tangible.
It's right? That's actually number eight. But yes, leverage, right? You can spend $90,000 to buy a $450,000 asset. Potential for improving assets. You can add on rooms. You can improve functionality. You can improve the yard. You can upgrade the bathroom, the kitchen, so on and so forth. Personal enjoyment, which we just talked about, right? Mm-hmm. If you do have a short-term rental, you can enjoy it. Potential for appreciation. Again, same thing. You're investing in something you know over the long term has always appreciated. Steady income stream, that cash flow, even if it's $100 versus $6,000.
You wake up still or not, it's still going to come in.
It's mail money, right? Tangibility just means it's something you can physically hold. And then finally, tax benefits. And
I mean, you could hug. I don't know if you could hold it, but.
But like you could, like.
Tax benefits,
yeah. You could. I could hug a pillar in my house.
Yeah, you could hug.
And then tax benefits. Like, there's a ton of different tax benefits that you can take advantage of when you own real estate. Those are my 10. Research them. Look them up. See if they make sense to you. But I am a firm believer, even as a mom and pop or owning one or two doors, if you own real estate, you will inherently be in a better position than 90% of the population.
The new country song, you can buy dirt, or yep. You should buy dirt.
Yeah, Luke Bryan, baby. Luke Bryan.
So, I mean, you covered pretty much the whole gamut with your damn 10, so.
I mean, it was just an easy.
I'm just going to say I'm with him.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's, if you're, if, so you're, actually, the, if you're in the
hold
mindset
on,
of.
Hold on. I speak from the perspective of somebody who has done investment properties, who owns investment properties. Let that be your one rock takeaway. As somebody who's experienced it, what would you say to somebody
so
who's looking to invest?
Or hesitant to invest.
Yeah.
Well, if you have capital, work with it. I mean, whenever I do my calculations in the past when I've done fix and flips, you know, high risk, high reward, not necessarily. There's the deals that you can find. One of my first ones was a short sale that I came across. I knew the people. I saw the numbers. If we would have totally, and excuse my language, shit canned it, we would have still walked away with a minimal profit.
Mm-hmm.
We did a good job. We walked away with a pretty damn good profit. Helped pay for my damn wedding at the time. So there's definitely going to be those deals where if there's a smart profit margin, and at the end of the day, you're going to win from the 10 lists that that Jameson gave you. But if your money is going to be pretty damn safe in real estate, unless something catastrophic happens, which that's in anything. Right now, the stock market's taking a plunge. And I said I wouldn't go into politics because I've got beat up a little bit on both sides, from my left side friends and my right side friends. They both beat up on me. I don't even give a shit.
It's like the Cupid Shuffle right now.
It's yeah, it's like, and at the end of the day, I don't really give a shit.
Three hops.
You know, those tariffs, they're wreaking havoc on the stock market, and now they're going to wreak havoc on the farming market.
So glad I bought my car 3 weeks ago versus 3 weeks from now.
But the one thing is parts. What is that going to look like? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's going to get ugly fast.
We're going to see where it's going to go.
Yeah,
maybe that's next week's.
We'll
we'll take a break from the politics.
Yeah, right? I always say stay hopeful. Fuck. I'm going to get beat up for that too. But anyway, my one rock takeaway is if you have a little bit of money burning a hole in your pocket, I think real estate's a safe bet when done right.
Or just invest, right? Like, how many
hell, times? Invest.
And you know this, and this is not racist at all. Promise. Looking at the camera, it's not.
Maybe a little bit.
But I just want to say minority community in general doesn't inherently trust banks. I'm saying that from my Puerto Rican side.
Oh, 100%. Right?
But so you hear a lot of
anybody from other countries, anybody that migrates here from other countries, most of them do not trust financial institutions.
Right. But what I'm saying is you hear a lot of stories about people having this cash and then stuffing it.
Mattress money.
In under the mattress, right? But it's because people don't understand inflation. And as if your $90,000 now sits under your mattress and we have, call it 3%, 2% inflation, every year from here, from today until the day you die, that 90,000 gets 2% less valuable every single year. So don't be afraid to invest. If it's not real estate,
so cool. Are you saying
find
that
a way to invest
in an TFP. Investment combats inflation?
Yep, it does.
Don't let your money get beat up by inflation. Yep. Invest it into something that's going to at least combat the inflation percentage.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
And no, I think it's not racist. It's a true statement.
No, it's a real thing. That's what I'm saying. Like my family,
I'm actually doing a first-time investor seminar in Spanish.
Nice.
I'll have all the stuff up. I'll put it on social media. We'll have it on link here. I'm going to do a test run. Maybe I shit can it. I don't know, guys. Let me know what you think. If you can't come out, there'll be the dates. It's going to be April 3rd and 4th. One in Denver, one in the Springs. Even if you're not Spanish speaking, the numbers are not, you know.
Yeah, I like
numbers it. Are numbers. They're not Spanish or English. They're numbers. So
this house is 4.6 million pesos.
All right.
Yeah, we're not doing currency. It's all in dollars. I think it's not racist. I think you've nailed it. It's something that needs to be needs to be said.
All right. So let's go ahead and move into our bourbon review for today's episode.
It's great. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for, you know where to reach us.
Thanks, Tony the Tiger.
It's great.
I think I've had enough bourbon at this point, whiskey at this point, at certain price points. That, and you guys know, I'm the one that's like, I hate the standard top shelf bourbons, especially Blanton's. I think I'm going to throw Eagle Rare in there with it. Don't get me wrong. Yeah.
Why?
With how I feel about it.
It's $50 for the bottle.
If you could find it.
If you could find it for $50, I'm seeing 65 to 75.
No. You can find it for 50. It should be, the retail on is 50.
It should be 50.
Just saying.
But that's, and again, I don't want to do the politics of it, but. This is a red state bourbon, which Canada is going to put at 75% tariff on, 25%, whatever it may be. So
prices. Yeah, but that affects Canada.
No, it affects us.
No, it doesn't.
They're not. They're going to stop buying. They're going to make it cost more
for them to buy it.
For them, to send it in.
Yeah.
Which again is going to slow down the demand.
I don't think it'll slow down.
Either way,
maybe the price will go down.
Hopefully.
I was going to say, I don't know. If anything, it'll bring the price down for us.
Yeah.
I hope that happens.
We're going to pay for a Crown Royal, but who's buying Crown Royal?
For me, this is exactly what I said at the beginning, though, is it scared me. Hold on. I think it opened for the worse.
Okay.
Only because I feel like you said it's going to get sweeter. I feel like it got more sour.
I'm gonna agree with you. It did get a little more bitter.
Yeah, I'm gonna hold on. Let me try JC's glass. And ethanol is still there. The alcohol is still there on the nose.
And you two could beat me up for this statement, but I think a good cheap bourbon that holds its own and just doesn't waver the path is Larceny. I like to come back to that.
Sipping JC's glass that stayed open, that wasn't touched, swirled, whatever it may be. Still there on the nose. Lost a little bit of the nose profile. Kind of with that open up. It's not as bitter as mine. But again, I don't think it has the complexity that I wanted.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
At the end.
That's fair.
I'll say that.
Yeah, that's fair.
I do think that this stands true to a bourbon mm-hmm. flavor, a bourbon taste, and that's why it is what it is. That's why it's Eagle Rare. That's why it's a staple on the top shelf. I just wish that it would have done a little bit more. If I'm going to give it a rock rating, only because it had so much honey, so much of that oak that could have rounded itself out. I think it kind of fizzled out for mm-hmm. me over time. So I think with this one, it's still a good bourbon, still has the flavor there. And again, most of the time, this isn't going to sit for an hour, 10 minutes.
Sure.
So I think I'm going to put it at a 3.3,
3.4. Okay. I'm going to agree with Charlie. I've never let Eagle Rare sit out for this long. Mm-hmm. I'm usually getting all the flavor notes that we had initially throughout my pour, which, I mean, JMO and I probably drink about the same at same pace. So I've always regarded it as a good bottle, which I still do.
Mm-hmm.
Which within the line of a Buffalo Trace, Eagle Rare is, I'm throwing it in the Blanton's area too, just because people have made it. If we could just find it across the board for $40-$50,
sure.
Yeah. I'd have a different opinion. But if I'm spending $70, $80, $90, I'm going EH all day.
Mm-hmm.
EH Taylor is just one of my favorites, or even just Buffalo Trace. It just
I was going to say that the barrel pick Buffalo that we had, I think was better than this.
But I also have my emotional ties to Eagle Rare. It was one of the first good bourbons that I've had. It's always been a staple around my friends. So that I can't rate it bad because of that. And the juice inside is good. It really is. It did get a little sour towards the end. It dissipated on all of the strong points at the beginning, but it's still not bad. It's still really good. Mm-hmm. I gave it 3.5. Yeah. Oh, wait. I got to do my...
Hey, there it is.
So I've cheated on this.
I'm getting a tablet.
I like Eagle Rare. I really do. It's one of my favorites. From a price point, I think it's
great. You ever put rocks in it?
Yeah, I'll put a single rock.
I was going to say, because maybe the rock would help.
It does. It definitely does.
Yeah.
I would agree with that.
I've never made an old-fashioned out of Eagle Rare.
Mm-hmm.
No, I have not either.
I don't know that I would.
Not with the sweetness up front, that I would make a Manhattan right out of the gate, 100% with Eagle Rare. Because I think that the vermouth would complement that sweetness, that honey.
A mint julep.
Caramel, yeah. Oh, man, this would be phenomenal. Yep. Like a summer day.
I don't have my pen, so it's not going to work. Anyway. Okay. So this is before this podcast was even a thought in my brain. We did a blind tasting with Blanton's, Eagle Rare, Buffalo Trace, not Barrel Select, just Buffalo Trace, E.H. Taylor, George T. Stagg, and Weller 107.
Okay. Paid for this, Jesus.
It was a group effort.
It was at Joey's place in Missouri.
Dang.
Yeah. So obviously you guys him and
some coin.
Well, him and JC have the bourbon collection of all collections, and his buddy who's a loan officer, Derek, brought his collection down. Anyway, we went to his house and we had the girls pour, and didn't tell us what was what, and then we had all of the shit lined up with numbers, and we ranked them, and then we did a force ranking. Out of all of those, the bourbon that came in last, out of all the ones I just said, what do you think it was?
Weller.
Eagle Rare.
Huh.
I
don't know, man.
Stag is a pungent,
yeah.
Good bourbon. It's mm-hmm. You know you're drinking Stag. You said Blanton's too?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would all kind of mix in when you're doing like Blanton's, Eagle Rare, and
we did,
and
we did.
Weller.
I mean, we went through, but like water, cleanse the palate.
EH Taylor, Stag.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are
yeah, they're hefty. Mm.
Those are grubby. Bourbons, you know. Wow.
And again, I think standard Buffalo Trace, for me, I have a better time drinking it.
So I'm gonna give this a 4.
Yep.
And I'm gonna tell you why. When you put a stamp on something,
I didn't want to be that harsh.
Yeah, no, but when you put a stamp on something and say it's 10-year,
mm-hmm.
you expect a certain outcome.
Yeah.
Right? So if you compare it to not E.H. Taylor, like a Buffalo Trace that's aged for what? Minimum 3?
Yeah, 3.
Mm-hmm. And it has more complexity than this.
Like I said, that barrel pick blew me away.
You know what I'm saying? It now, if delicious. I can buy this, at $50, cool.
All day.
Yeah.
If I'm buying it at 60 or 70, I'm choosing something else.
It ends up, it opened up.
I mean, I will say on ice, it does open up more.
The 3-chord that we had last week.
Yeah.
Was 55, 60.
Don't tell Oscar about that.
we'll talk about it after. Would you rate it?
Like 2.2?
2.2, 2.3.
So this.
It was so good.
It
was 112.
Yeah.
Proof. Oh, dang.
Yeah. And it tasted better than this.
Yeah.
I like Eagle Rare. I do. And I have an affinity towards it. Drink it. If I can buy it at $50.
It is made for the market that it sits
yes,
in.
100%.
I haven't had Eagle Rare in a very long time.
Yeah.
Now, since we've been doing this podcast for a while and we've had a lot of different bourbons, I still have my respect for it. I have my memories. I have all of that. I enjoy it, but it is now. I'm glad we did this.
If this was 15 years ago, when the bourbon market was not what it was, what it is now.
It's a 10 year, right?
Yeah,
so I look at it and go, we had McKenna 10 year.
Yep.
Better.
Yep.
We had Elijah Craig, Private Barrel Selects, 10 year. Better. Like, you just expect
a little bit more.
Yeah. And I think, and I disagree with you on this, I don't think it got worse as it opened up, but it didn't add anything.
No, well,
it just stayed the same.
And it got a little,
you know what I'm saying?
I did taste the slight more bitter.
Yeah.
And I kind of, this is going to get put in the same category as Basil Hayden for me.
Yeah. Yep.
I'm probably not going to buy it.
The Basil Hayden 10 year, remember?
Yeah. Yeah, that exactly.
Which you missed that episode too, actually.
I did too.
Yep.
And it was like, it's 10, but why?
Yeah.
So exactly. Now the question is, I don't know that I would go out of my way to find or seek out the 20 year. I want
to.
I'm curious.
I would like to.
I'm curious.
I would like to see.
Just to see.
I would like to
what
see.
What would especially an extra 10 years do to this?
I don't know.
Especially if it's the same distillery that does Pappy.
Right.
And they're saying that Eagle Rare 20.
Or 25.
Or 25, whatever. Like, I'd want to try it just to be like, okay,
I have had
this.
Double Eagle Rare.
Yeah.
And I would. That is
that
good
would fit that. Okay. That's but if you take one. This and double it, it would be way more complex. It would
right.
be way. Yeah. 100%. Great.
So, yeah.
Great. Guys. Yeah.
I like it. It's cool. It's a lot of memories with the bottle. At this point of my juncture with bourbon, if I could buy it for $40, I'll buy it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Anything over $40, $50, I'm leaving
no,
it right
no,
on
yeah,
that
walk
shelf.
Away. Yeah, 100%. 100%. With that being said, guys, like I said, you can always come here to the Rouge. They have an extensive list of bourbons that you can try. You can try it a pour. You could buy a bottle.
And don't rely on the online menu.
Yes.
They have a ton more.
Way more than what's online. Definitely come in and check them out. Get that special that they have going on with the green, yellow, and gold for $58, 2 ounce pours. Definitely take advantage of that because I know that if I would pay for the gold spot, and it
gold
it
spot alone
like,
should be $50 a pour.
But if it turned out like this,
did you guys try it?
I'd be upset.
No, but it's different, dude. I don't think we. Maybe this is an off-camera topic. I just don't think we would enjoy it because Irish whiskey is just
totally different.
It's a different,
totally different.
It's a different monster.
Thank you guys for tuning in, as always. Drop us a follow, like, subscribe to the channel to see all of the stuff that we have going on in 2025. Follow us along, get notifications on when new episodes drop. We do topics like this all the time. But you can always reach out to us on our own individual platforms. That's social media, wherever it is.
Oscar the Realtor, Oscar the Realtor CO.
You can find me at Charlie Sardelli, TikTok, Instagram. If you're looking for any video production, podcast info, you can find me at Beat the Jeans Productions.
And the Colorado Real Estate Guy or Jameson Amoros.
Love it.
Super simple.
Love it. Oscar Barra,
Yeah. If you want to get with us, ask us any questions about the podcast, give us recommendations, tell us what you want us to drink and try out and review, you can always reach out to us, RESOTR@themilehighperspective.com, or give us a phone call or a text.
720-584-3361.
And we'll get back to you guys. Seriously, thank you so much for all the support you've been giving us. We appreciate you more than you know. We look forward to doing this every week.
Any and all comments are appreciated.
Yes.
Give us a call. Drop us a comment. It's been the norm for me this week, even if you just want to yell at me over politics.
I love it. I love it. But on that note, guys, always drink responsibly. Come out to the Rouge. Have a good time. We will catch you later. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you for tuning into this week's episode of Real Estate Served on the Rocks. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and really anywhere that you listen to podcasts. To see the video version, subscribe to our YouTube channel at Living in Colorado, The Mile High Perspective. To stay up to date with all the events and specials going on at the Rouge Wine and Bourbon Bistro, visit their website, therougewinebar.com.